Hello, I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to tonight's edition of Mind Over Matter, a monthly Monday evening radio show that is dedicated to making our Alaska listeners' lives more mindful and rich with meaning. Global warming is the most significant environmental issue of our time, yet effective action, especially in the U.S., has been meager. Given the current crisis and threat to our planet, why have so few of us taken any action? Much has been written about the oil companies' disinformation campaigns in the U.S., but even educated, well-informed Americans seem to live in a state of denial, minimization, apathy. Why? Well, tonight I am so fortunate to be able to interview Dr. Kari Norgaard, a professor of sociology and environmental science at the University of Oregon. Her book, Living in Denial, searches for answers to this question, drawing on interviews and ethnographic data from her study of a rural community in western Norway during an unusually warm winter. When the snowfall came 2 months later than usual, ice fishing was impossible, and their ski area had to rely on artificial snow. And this in a town where winter tourism was economically important. Do you see the comparison to Juneau? Well, stories in the newspapers in Norway linked the warm winter explicitly to global warming, and still, residents didn't write letters to the editor, didn't pressure politicians, or even cut down on their use of fossil fuels. Dr. Norgaard has gone on to write numerous articles on the psychosocial aspects of climate change denial and apathy as it exists in the U.S. and in other countries. And she has been invited to present her research at hundreds of conferences around the world, including once in Juneau in 2011 at the University of Alaska Southeast. Now, I'd like to welcome Dr. Kari Norgaard, who's joining us by phone. Welcome, Kari.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, well, welcome back, I could say. But it's a rainy day, so it's okay. I'm curious, how did you become interested in this topic?
Thanks so much. Yeah, I became interested actually first when I was teaching. I was teaching courses about environmental problems, and my students found the information very discouraging, not surprisingly. And I noticed that some students reacted with a lot of, you know, sort of feeling or outrage, and other students didn't react much at all. And I became interested in how people receive information that's really disturbing. And I have ancestry in Norway. I've spent some time living there myself, and I ended up deciding I wanted to look at everyday life and how people actually experience information about climate change in everyday life, and centering from the idea that it is disturbing information and difficult to make sense of.
And it's really great that for us, at least here in Alaska, that your comparative work is with a country like the state of Alaska that is oil dependent. And so I think the parallels are terrific to talk about today. Let's begin. Tell us about your research in Norway, what came up. Did people talk about climate change?
Great, thank you. Yes, so just to start off, I want to make clear, because often when we talk about denial, people think that the work I do is about the more overt, those that say climate change is not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And my work is about people who believe climate change is happening but aren't particularly engaging, who are essentially not responding in accordance with how serious the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that the scientific community, those, you know, who are in the physical sciences and who are biological scientists, who are looking at the data and seeing how, you know, how things look 10 years out, 20 years out, and beyond, and are wondering how come the public is not responding. Most of those people are looking at this as, oh, people just do not understand. They don't understand. They need more information. And my work is essentially saying that information alone is not enough, that when information is very, very disturbing to our sense of who we are, is very emotionally disturbing and very threatening to our political and economic structures, that a certain portion of people under some circumstances just don't want to know about it. Maybe everybody doesn't want to know disturbing information, but some under some conditions we might be able to respond more effectively than others. So I look at culture and economics and so forth as connected to how people think about climate change and whether they're really able to imagine it as being real at all.
Do you notice a difference between younger people, say 20, 30-something, informed people who know about climate change, and people in, you know, older, middle-aged and older adults? Do you see a difference?
That's a great question. You know, I haven't, so the research that I did, I haven't looked at that specifically. And I would say within the research I did, I didn't see, you know, I didn't break it down and try to go after that particular question, although I think it's a good one and I can comment on it. But more generally, what I did find is that there were three emotions that people raised that made it more difficult for them to think about climate change. One was a feeling of helplessness or hopelessness about the future. One was a sense of guilt because people are concerned about, you know, have their own responsibility. Both the United States and Norway are heavy contributors to the problem, and so there's a sense of guilt or that there's somehow we're wrong or bad. And then third, fear about the future. What does this mean for the future? And I could well imagine, you know, that those emotions play out differently for different age groups, as well as many other things, but I didn't study it specifically. What I will say is that after having done the research, a number of young people suggested that I should also be focusing on anger, you know, a sense that they are born into the situation that for which they were not responsible, which to a certain extent all of us have been, you know, the systems that are in place, you know, that the organization of our fossil fuels, our economy around fossil fuels is begun before any of our lifetimes. But it's a good question. I won't say that. I mean, maybe other people have ideas about that. But age per se is not something that I had done much on.
Well, I was thinking of the obvious thing. If you're 60 years old or 70, you could believe that you're not going to be around for the worst of it. And I'm noticing in our small town of Juneau that many of the people rising up now are 20, 30-somethings. And what somebody told me the other day was, of course, they have young children, and they know the science, and they know they're going to experience the tremendous loss of the natural world. And Juneau is very dependent on the natural world. Most of us are here because we love it. And we're not in big cities, so we're not worried about subways flooding in Manhattan. We're worried about losing our trees. We're worried about not having any snow. So anyways, I am noticing that given the age, if two people have the same amount of knowledge and one of them is 25 and the other is 75, I think it makes a big difference on how impacted they think they're going to be.
I could believe that, and it's interesting, and I think that, you know, age could intersect with the different reasons that people, you know, start becoming more active on this. I gave a talk in a church here in Eugene a month ago, and I would say there it was mostly older people, but it could have been the constituency of that particular setting.
Uh-huh. And when you gave the talk, that you must be doing little mini ethnographies, because at that church you got to see what kind of, you got to see the reaction of people. What kind of reaction was there?
Well, one thing I've noticed is that this book came out in 2011. I guess it had just come out when I was up there in Juneau with you last. And when I was doing this work and around the time the book came out, there was a lot less engagement than there has been now. And I think that on the one hand, you know, in the United States, we've had very intensive, you know, climate skeptic campaigns, such that the number of people who don't think it's happening, you know, increased as a result of, you know, lots and lots of money that was put into different, you know, media outlets to try to create the sense that there wasn't happening. And those campaigns were very effective, and so we had a period where more and more people were questioning whether it's really happening. That seems to have lessened somewhat. And, well, I am seeing for sure in the last several years, 3 years, and, you know, even more in the last 1 year here in this community, is that more and more people are becoming very alarmed and concerned about what's going on. As we've seen, you know, the month of July was the hottest on record. I don't know the specifics of what's happening there in Juneau, but here in this part of the state, our local ski areas, we have two, and neither of them were, well, one, they were both able to open for just a couple of days. There was no ski season here, and this is the first time this has happened. You know, we have very low water in our rivers, and people are asking, you know, going out and buying air conditioning units where no one has had air conditioning, the need for it before, or asking, you know, what does this mean? Sure, we have a hot summer this year, but really beginning to realize it's not just a matter of having one hot summer, but that this is a long-term trend.
And we're parallel to you. We had very warm weather in spring, which had our plants jump up, and people are talking about their gardens being over a month early. We've had greater storms, more rain, less snow, and just like you, our ski area opened up for only a day or two. And I believe that was the first time we've ever had that sad event happen. So I think people, well, this is actually a question. Do you think that extreme weather events like Superstorm Sandy, like major heat spells where people die, do you think these extreme weather events may, and I know your research wasn't specifically on this, change people's denial?
That's a great question, because a lot of people say that it will. And I think that it's, you know, we all, in general in the United States, there's this perception, you know, that people are rational and that, you know, when we learn of a risk, we would respond to it. But it's also the case, if you look at, you know, people who smoke or engage in different behaviors that aren't good for our health and are aware of relationships between, you know, cancer and smoking or whatever the things are, and people don't necessarily respond in a rational way to risk, even when we understand what it is. I think in the case of my work, you know, has any truth to it, the idea here is that emotions that are very disturbing, people are motivated to avoid them. Now, that is, you know, longstanding theory from psychology, and that if people see these things, it brings a lot of fear, and that people are motivated to avoid fear. And so it's not just that seeing or experiencing a large-scale disaster will automatically lead people to engage. It could be that they will get involved with all kinds of coping mechanisms, you know, watch more comedy TV or shopping or whatever way people attempt to, you know, hang on to that sense of what's normal reality. But what I do think is important at this moment in time, a lot of why, from the interviews that I've done both in Norway and the United States, a lot of why people feel so afraid and helpless has to do with the lack of visibility of real alternatives and real sense of what can be done. And so if you are reading data about climate change or watching your garden come on into bloom and things start moving a month earlier than usual, but nobody around you is talking about it, there's nothing that you can see that you can really do as an individual, and your political leaders are not doing anything about it or giving mixed messages. in the sense of Obama announcing strong climate policy and then also talking about increasing drilling, then it exacerbates that feeling of helplessness that there's nothing that can be done. So I think it's very important in this moment in time that we have real conversations about what we can do. I think the chances that we are going to be able to avoid the catastrophic kinds of climate change are not really good at this time. I mean, we're talking about large-scale change, but the only way we can actually make that change is if we have real conversation about how to get there. And I think that's increasing. You know, we're seeing more real conversation at the national level. We're at a very important moment in time right now because starting the last week of November, early December, will be the next chance for the international community to come together to create an agreement on climate emissions. So it's a great time to give a very strong signal that that is important. I think it's extremely important.
Did you say the last chance for the international community?
Well, some people are saying, I'm not sure if I said that. Some people are saying it's the last chance in that, you know, the further along we are, the more difficult it is, the more emissions that are out there, the more difficult it is to cut. And so this agreement in Paris is, you know, is an important opportunity to try to get a binding agreement on for countries to reduce emissions. And some people say, you know, we've been working towards that for several years for this agreement. And some people say if we can't do it this year, by the time we get everything together to do another agreement, it will be, you know, beyond. So mm-hmm. I don't think in language like that is necessarily, like last chance is necessarily the way we want to go, because I personally have been hearing my whole life about how it's the last chance for this or that. But the point is, this is a very important moment at the international level, and it's an important moment for people to put pressure on our leaders to come to an agreement, to come to a very strong climate agreement.
As I understand it, one of the most proactive groups in the U.S. at least is Bill McKibben's group, 350.org. And I was wondering if they would bring you in to take a look, to get advice on how best to encourage people to, let's just say, attend demonstrations, to get in the streets. Have they been using any of your work?
Not that I know specifically. I mean, I know people shared my book with Bill McKibben, and I mean, certainly he's been an incredibly important force in us, our movement forward. I think, you know, I think that if they were to ask me, I would say that, you know, there's sort of a circular effect, and I don't, you know, we have a new 350 group here in Eugene, and it's you know, rising up, or it's getting a lot of momentum. But by circular effect, I mean that it can be easy to look around and sort of blame people and be upset. Well, how come nobody's doing anything? But I think that the more people who are engaged, or the more that we can get information about climate change into the media, into various things, so that people realize if they stand up, speak out, take some action, they're not alone. It makes it more worthwhile. I mean, we know this is not a problem that any of us can solve as an individual. We really need each other. We need large-scale social movements. We need large-scale people working you know, at all of the levels of the organizations that we're part of to figure out how to reduce emissions and all these things. And so the more that we see other people part of it, the more people are able to, I think, move through that denial and engage.
Well, from what I've read about your work, you said the main, this is what I gleaned, is that psychologically speaking, the main impediment to action, of doing something, writing a letter to the editor, joining, donating money, or even getting in the streets, is a sense that there's nothing you can do about it. So it just has you. Actually, it's a very healthy psychological mechanism. There are some things we can't do anything about. This may not be one of them, but there are some things. And it's very healthy to let it go and just to go on with life as normal. You can't change your job, perhaps, or you can't change how your children are. So in that way, it's an accommodation that's very psychologically healthy. In this case, it's, of course, disastrous because it's a misperception that you can't do anything about it. Could you go into some more detail? You use some technical terms that we don't use in psychology, tools of order and tools of innocence in your research. Could you unpack a little more some of the emotions that what our reactions are to this one never before experienced threat to humanity? Could you give us some explanation of those emotions and what we do?
Sure, absolutely. So I build on theory of psychology, probably the most powerful theory of psychology, the idea of cognitive dissonance. We not have the two thoughts in our mind at one time, and we then jettison one of them. And I build on this in terms of, for example, guilt. So if people, Americans have, we no longer have the total largest carbon foot contribution. That's now on or goes to China. But we do have the largest historical, in terms of our emissions, our collective emissions to the carbon that's out there. Most of it comes from the United States. We also have the largest per capita carbon footprint. Or did last time I looked at the data. It could be it's changed, but I'd be surprised. So that makes people a sense of guilt. It's like our carbon-intensive lifestyle is causing harm to people in other communities who are experiencing large-scale storms, to other species, and so forth. And that can raise a sense of, that I'm a bad person, or that as Americans, we're not in the lead. I believe people want to have a sense of, pride at the individual and collective level of who they are, and rightfully so. And so that idea of cognitive dissonance, you can think about that at the individual level. People will be like, oh, well, that's just not happening, or that can't be true, because of the cognitive dissonance there around guilt or being good, being a good person or a good Americans or good people. And this can also happen at the more the level of cultural practices, and we can think about how the economic for people whose economic well-being is more directly tied to these extractive industries or to the production of fossil fuels in different ways. That sense of cognitive dissonance would be even greater. That it can be even more disturbing or unacceptable to see. I think all of us believe and understand, I mean, maybe I'm naive, but that we are good people. And so that comes in conflict. And so there's also cultural practices, and this is the idea of tools of order, ways that when our sense of identity as good people, as good Americans is threatened, ways that people reinstate that order. Through changing the conversation, through talking about other aspects of things they've done well at, talking about other ways, that oil or other industry has done a good job or been able to reduce emissions or whatever it is. So these cultural practices are ways that people might change a conversation, ways that people might tell a joke, point a finger at someone else, oh, the real problem is China. Or for people who do understand the science on climate change, pointing the finger at the climate skeptic movement and saying, oh, that's the problem, instead of saying, how come I'm not doing more, taking responsibility for what I know.
I was wondering what your reaction is to gallows humor cartoons I'm seeing coming up more and more. In fact, there's a cartoon strip in our local newspaper that references climate change a lot, and making a joke out of it has a psychological benefit, does it not?
Yeah, humor is a really interesting thing, and I mean, there are sociologists who study humor, and humor can play a lot of roles in how we understand ourselves, in shaming. Shame is a very powerful emotion, and trying to belittle, different constituencies. I don't know what kinds of cartoons you're referring to, but there's a lot of different ways that humor can be used to either shake things up and show other possible interpretations of a situation, or to try to reassert the status quo by shaming individuals who organizations or ideas, emergent ideas. I can't remember who it was that says first they ignore you, then they belittle you, then something or other, and then you win. But certainly it's, if there's humor that is in response to a climate movement, it may be a sign that there's a threat that that climate movement is making to what's happening in the community and how people understand who they are and what, you know, what is the good life and what they should be doing.
One author,
I'll just say this. Uh-huh. I'm very sympathetic to that threat. I think that I don't think that people who, probably most of the people who are listening to this show have high, much higher carbon footprints as individuals than are tenable and, are to some extent part of the problem, you might say. And I don't think that they are bad people, but I think that we as a culture have to figure out how to change course. And, we get to do that together. And if it's disturbing to try to figure it out, there's nobody for whom this is not a disturbing problem, I believe.
Oh, yes. Well, going on with life as normal in the face of what may be, for those who are informed in the back of their mind, total catastrophe, it takes a lot of work. In my field, I'm a psychotherapist, living in denial is exhausting. I mean, we talk about people who really suppress a lot of stuff, and you can see it on their faces. It creates stress. It creates tension. So though the truth may be painful, ultimately being not having to keep pushing it down, not having to avoid conversations, not read the article in the newspaper. I mean, we have this little local newspaper called the Juneau Empire, which I love because I read it every morning. And there isn't one day, I don't think, that doesn't have two or three articles that are directly related to climate change. Right now it's wildfires. You wouldn't be able to read the newspaper. And so the mechanisms for pushing this down, have you looked at that, the cost of it?
I'm really glad you brought this up. While at the societal level, there's obviously a downside to engaging in denial. And we talked about how at the, at the individual level, sometimes denial can make sense. Like, if something is too big or you really have no control over it, like say that you're in a bad job and you just have to keep on, or whatever the thing is in your life that, we can't all be always taking in all information. That would be impossible. And yet at the collective level, as a society, we have to respond. And if we have all of this sort of mechanisms that are suppressing our ability to respond by suppressing public engagement. But at the individual level, it is also problematic, absolutely, for people's mental health. And I have two things to say about it. One is when I was first working on this project, I read the work of Robert J. Lifton, who he wrote about the experience of the development of nuclear weapons and the possibility of nuclear war, which is not something we talk about all that much anymore, but it's still, of course, a real threat. And he was interested in a number of things, but in terms of the kinds of impacts this has for people. And he wrote about how when we cannot let ourselves think about certain things, really there are deep individual psychological costs in terms of your sense of empowerment, the sense of possibility, and one's enjoyment of life. Similarly, there were people who did studies probably back in the 80s in families of young people, high school students. In particular, I don't remember the authors, but the book was called No Place to Talk About It. And they found that high school students, when the parents were not talking about, not telling them about what was happening, they were aware of the possibility of nuclear war. They were aware that their parents were very afraid. And it was very damaging in those families where there was not conversation. In contrast, where the families where they did talk about it, the kids felt more empowered and more did better. So the last thing I'll say is just an anecdote from the talk that I mentioned that I gave earlier in this church. The two individuals who started our local 350 chapter, one of them was a farmer before this, and she talked about how disturbing it was all the time as she was working and doing things with her land and watching things and just things that were not right, and she was really terrified and felt helpless and overwhelmed. And then after she founded this chapter and became very active in trying to effect change, she says she doesn't feel hopeless at all, and that she's very, it's really improved her quality of life. So I thought that was an interesting, it was great to hear it from her experience directly.
That's wonderful. Hey, Carrie, what we're going to do is take a little break, and then I want to get back and talk about more of the psychology of climate change, minimization, and denial. So if you have just joined us, I'm talking with Dr. Carrie Marie Norgaard, a professor at the University of Oregon whose research focuses on the psychological and social aspects of denial and apathy regarding climate change. We'll take a short break with a little music and be right back. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and the topic is the psychology of climate change denial. And I'm talking to the University of Oregon professor of sociology and environmental science, Dr. Carrie Norgaard. And Carrie, welcome back. Carrie's on the phone from Eugene, Oregon. A question. We're talking about why so few people are taking any kind of action. And one of the articles that I mentioned to you, I think, that really talks about grief, that people are grieving. They know these losses, like the community, I'm thinking of the community in Norway, where people had that warm winter. And I read some of the interviews that you did, and people were really sad, thinking that their children won't be able to do ice fishing and won't be able to ski. How do you relate to the grief aspect? What do you think about that?
Thank you for picking up on that. I think it's really important, and I think it's, you know, one of the things that my work is about too is the relationship between emotions and thinking, and that, so, you know, thinking and understanding certain things about the world leads to emotional responses like grief, and also that as we experience something profoundly difficult, like grief about, you know, changing ecosystems, the places that we love, grief about what's happening in the lives of people that we love, that shapes what we do and don't allow ourselves to think about, at least, you know, throughout the day in different ways. And, you know, when you think about the degree of change in our world, the numbers of species, the pervasiveness of this problem, the grief can be very profound, and as well it should be. You know, we have a great capacity. People, I'm sure, in Alaska feel great love for the, you know, the fish that are there, the species that they like to hunt, or go hiking and observe, or whatever, and the idea that things are not well with the world in those ways, or that they cannot have their children doing things, or for Indigenous people carrying on cultural practices that require the presence of those other beings to continue. You know, it's grief is a very significant part of that.
Well, I was just thinking of our much-beloved Salmon Derby. And if you take a look at the data, every year the winning fish, the winning salmon, gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And the data is right there, but nobody talks about it, at least openly. It's very interesting to see the data and then no commentary. I read an article, Kari, recently, that some of the top climate scientists are coming out of their labs. First, they're experiencing incredible stress and cognitive dissonance. The cognitive dissonance is, how should they deal with knowing what's happening and remaining coolly unperturbed in their laboratories and not going out on the front lines? Have you heard anything about this?
Not specifically. I know that I was on a radio show on CBC earlier this summer that was a show that the journalist decided to do. It was a show about climate anxiety, and he became interested in doing this because, mm-hmm. as a journalist, he was feeling so much anxiety covering all of these stories about climate change, and none of them were positive, and he wondered how scientists were handling it, and he wondered if there was any work on how people were handling it, and that's how he found my work. And in part from him, I know there's a project, the website called Is This What You Feel?, where a person has done a bunch of work with scientists on how they experience climate change, and I know there's been other research on that, and I think it's... Certainly, we can think about scientists being on the forefront of really comprehending what's happening. And for the rest of us, you know, we begin to comprehend it as it unfolds in our lives, but we aren't as intimately aware of the trends in terms of what this means 10 years, 50 years out, and so forth. So I think in that sense, what's happening in the scientific community is a window into the future for many other people. And I also know that James Hansen, who has been the top climate scientist, so the first person to testify before Congress back in 1988, has become very active as a result of his understanding. And I do think that there is a moral component to this. I do believe we have a moral responsibility at this moment in time to engage. And so for scientists, their engagement may be to continue producing that work. And so they are hoping that others will, who are not trying to, you know, who may have a different role in society, will step up. And I'm guessing as they see that there isn't a lot of stepping up, it makes it very difficult for those people.
Well, somebody who just stepped up is Pope Francis. And so this is new since your book was written and your research was done. Suddenly we have the moral component of climate change front and center with our own Pope speaking so eloquently about what's happening and linking it to capitalism and consumerism. I mean, what this new moral dimension, and you just spoke at a church, do you feel that a real important window has opened to allow people to become engaged, especially people of faith in faith communities, because it is seen as a moral issue?
Absolutely. I think that this is the kind of leadership that we need. You know, again, when we spoke earlier, I was talking about how people are aware that this is not a problem they as individuals can respond to, but then when you look around and you don't see leadership at the large level, you don't see important political figures, or you don't see lots of other people, that it becomes very discouraging. So I think the fact that the Pope has done this is profoundly important in terms of sending a signal to those who, of course, follow him directly, but also sending a signal to people who are not Catholic in terms of that they are not going to be alone on this, and that there really is a strong moral component that we have for life. And I think that that moral dimension is very different than, you know, we had good research that came out. It's incredibly important to have, from economists talking about that economic benefits of responding now to climate change, but it will be much more in our economic interest to do so, and that's important. But it's a different kind of argument than to say this really is our moral responsibility to figure out how to become engaged.
Mm-hmm. We've had successful massive social movements, or partially successful social movements, in the past, and I'm thinking of the civil rights movement. So I'm sure people have asked you why some social and environmental problems result in people rising up and others do not. So have you ever made any comparisons between social movements?
Sure. Well, I think that the civil rights is a great one. I think that the end of slavery in this country is also a good one, because to think about times when very profound social change have occurred. One thing that I tell my students all the time is, you know, they look at the world and they think, you know, there's nothing can be done, I'm so small or so hopeless, but social change is happening all the time, and things are and will change, and we, I believe, have a responsibility to be a part of figuring out how to get to a livable future. And we can look at other moments, even in our recent political history in the United States, when there have been economic, cultural, and social and political systems organized, for example, around slavery, which were changed. And at the time, before those things happened, it looked impossible that it would occur. And yet they do. And sometimes it can occur very quickly. And we don't always know. You know, sometimes a very small trigger event will actually lead to all kinds of effects that nobody had predicted, which will in turn, you know, so affect others. So, you know, when somebody takes the time to write a letter to the newspaper, they may say, well, what's the point of this, you know? But who knows how many people will read that, who will experience, what difference it will make for them. and what they will do as a result of this, and so on and so forth.
Okay. So as probably as an organizing tool, it's really good to remind people that what seem like intractable social problems like slavery or apartheid in South Africa are now things of the past. And it was because people rose up. It was really grassroots. That's the important thing. It was grassroots pushing. Let's take the civil rights movement. Grassroots, people in the streets pushing politicians to make essential legal changes. Didn't end Jim Crow totally, but it went a long way.
Absolutely. I think that it's, it's very easy to look at any particular problem and feel like it's too overwhelming. Why bother? And I think that by reading the words of people who've participated in social change, surrounding yourself by people who have done so, and, thinking about studying the histories of that, you can realize that social change is happening all the time. And I do believe that for individuals, it can be very meaningful to be a part of it. It can be very empowering, as we discussed a little bit earlier, not thinking about things that you know are happening but are disturbing requires actually quite a bit of mental and emotional energy and has different kind of psychological costs in terms of people's sense of possibility and self-esteem and these kinds of things, whereas it can take time to write a letter to the editor or to contact a congressman or start working on your local regional climate action plan. Whatever the kinds of things are, there's so many things that do need to be done, and it can be rewarding not only for the world in terms of that outcome, but it can be personally rewarding for people to be involved in that work as well.
Well, I can speak personally from years and years ago. When I was a graduate student at the University of Washington, I attended a talk by a physician, Dr. Helen Caldicott, who was one of the founders of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And I knew nothing or virtually nothing at that time about the threat of nuclear weapons. And after the talk, I walked out of there so stunned. It was like I had accidentally walked into, for a normal exam, into a doctor's office, and they told me I had a terminal illness. And I actually, the news about the threat of nuclear disaster so moved me. I was so shocked that at that point I started becoming active in the peace movement. And as a psychotherapist, what I've noticed is so many of my clients really are compassionate and feel great, great sadness for what's going on, their own privilege, and then the relative poverty of others, the suffering that's going on in the world. And what I found is when they engage in action, even at a local level, for example, we have a local soup kitchen here called the Glory Hole, and if they volunteer once a month or once a week at the Glory Hole, that impacts them so positively, because rather than carrying the suffering, I can't do anything about it, on their shoulders, they are tithing their time or tithing their energy and doing something about it, and it's uplifting. So I'm very interested to hear, you've had similar experiences, that doing something, even a little something, you don't have to live in denial with that energy, negative energy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to trivialize the difficulty of what we're up against and say that, there's some, easy, quick fix for this, but absolutely, I think that the comparison of not becoming engaged, it can be very meaningful for people to, to join together with local groups, to write letters, to, again, look at things with your, get involved in things in your local community, even though it's difficult to figure out exactly what can be done. There are other people around you who are also working on that, and different communities are at different have different kinds of opportunities to be a part of Leverage Point. So we can think about how something that somebody does that may be fairly small could actually have, if it's thought out well and so forth, could actually have a pretty big impact and be meaningful along the way. And earlier I mentioned the local example of the woman here who was very overwhelmed, who's a farmer and feels, does not feel hopeless at all now that she's started the 350.org chapter. Of course, not all of us are able to to go out and start an organization and so forth. But I think that we do have a responsibility to use the knowledge that we have about the world, and that it can be very meaningful and very satisfying to do so.
Thank you. And we are going to, though we're coming towards the end of the show, we're going to have a very short music break. And I want to remind our listeners that I'm talking with Dr. Carrie Norgaard, a professor at the University of Oregon, who has conducted research on the social and psychological aspects of climate change denial and apathy. So let's have a little music, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and the topic tonight is the psychology and sociology of climate change denial. And I'm talking by phone with University of Oregon Professor of Sociology and Environmental Science, Dr. Carrie Norgaard. And Carrie, I have a very different question to ask you for the tail end of our show. And this is what, when I was reading your research, this is what really interested me, as well as the individual. It was the large culture. The richer you are, the more climate you emit, the more carbon you emit, because the two go hand in hand, the less you care. You wrote that people in nations with higher carbon emissions are not only less likely to be impacted by the direct effects of climate change, but they're also less likely to show concern regarding climate change. What is that about?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I believe that particular study that I cite there was by a Norwegian scholar named Hanna Sandvik, but it's been replicated in different ways at the state level, within the United States, and so forth. I don't know that it's I don't know all of the different ways that this type of trend plays out, but it is very interesting. You know, we have often this hierarchy of needs idea: if people only had a certain amount, then they would, once they have enough for themselves, maybe they'll give more to others. But it turns out it doesn't necessarily work that way. And the negative relationship between carbon emissions or wealth and concern about climate change, you know, that may not all be consistent sort of as climate impacts become more visible. I haven't seen a recent update of that. But I would interpret that finding as having to do with some of the things I spoke about earlier in terms of guilt and national identity, that we know that climate impacts, people are impacted more in poor nations, in parts of the country, you know, the vulnerability, and people are impacted more whereas those who are more responsible for the problem may and often do feel a sense of guilt and are more threatened by the idea that the ways that they're able to support the lifestyle that they want or these kinds of things are harming others. And so that's where that cognitive dissonance can come in, which is probably part of what's going on with that finding.
And also, those of us in rich nations who are relatively affluent, we're more protected from climate change. I mean, the sewers just overflowed on Waikiki Beach, so that's going to impact some affluent tourists. But aside from due to storms, due to unusual rain, but aside from that, we're in our air-conditioned cars, air-conditioned homes, and can even take vacations to escape the smoke in Montana.
Sure.
So we're more protected. This winds up our show, Kari, and I am so thankful to you for taking an hour out of your busy academic life, and I want to thank you for sharing your rich knowledge about the deep psychological and social barriers to acting effectively to reduce the worst effects of climate change. And sitting with me right now in the studio is Jeff Brown, and I do want to thank Jeff for contributing his technical expertise to tonight's show. And thanks to our listeners to tuning in to a very difficult topic to listen to. And if you stayed on the show, you're going to get a special certificate. So don't forget to join us next month on Monday night at 7. Good night.